Shall we play a game?
What is with meat space?
You didn't say the magic word.
The files are in the computer?
We're only using a simple polyphonetically grouped 20 square digit key transpose from booster phonic form with multiple nulls.
After very careful consideration, sir, I've come to the conclusion that your new defense system sucks.
So the combination is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So it's a code breaker. No, it's the code breaker. Mike, it's season 3, episode 1 of the Cyber Tap. Man, we're back.
We're back.
Well, we're excited to be with everyone for this first episode of season 3, and we've got a good one for you. So things are a little different, but we're keeping the topics mostly the same. We're going to unpack the news, slightly different format. We're going into a more interview style with our guests. And I got to tell you, Mike, we've brought out, as I mentioned, the big guns for episode 1.
The heavy artillery has made an appearance.
Yeah, unbelievable. We got Professor Eugene Spafford, goes by Spaff, one of the best cyber minds at the university and recognized across the country as a cyber expert. We had the chance to sit down and talk with him. So let's get to it. The Cyber Tap featuring Spaff. How's it going, Mike?
Good. Well, the pandemic persists. We're isolated, we're quarantined, and we're social distance. It's half past who knows when because I'm in the basement with no sense of the passage of time. What I do know, it's time for season 3 of the Cyber Tap.
That's right. And we had a fun summer season. So we spent a lot of time outside. We talked about our summer projects and we reviewed movies. And that was a good time. I think we're going to try in this upcoming season 3 to bring some of those segments back every once in a while. We won't make them the primary focus. But I saw some movies I hadn't seen. And I'm still telling people about Who Am I, the German film that we last reviewed. It was a good one. And we continue to say Benjamin. that was fun. We had a fun season. But to get us kicked off for the fall semester here at Purdue, we're all, as always, mixing it up a little bit. We're really focusing on bringing in some interesting folks. And Mike, for the first episode of season 3, we're bringing out the guns.
I know.
I know. My only fear is that from now on it's a letdown. Now, if any of our other guests
we're setting the bar too high.
We might be setting it high. Maybe this should have been season finale. But folks, today we really have the exciting opportunity to talk to Dr. Eugene Spafford. And now Spaff is one of the most well-known names, not only at Purdue Cybersecurity, but in the cybersecurity industry. Celebrating his 34th year at Purdue and 40 years in the industry. And this is an exciting opportunity for the Cyber Tap. So Spaff, welcome to the show. It is absolutely wonderful to have you.
I'm really pleased to be here. And hopefully I won't be too disruptive for future speakers.
No, of course not. Of course. We want you to set the bar high. We're excited to have you, especially the kickoff episode, the first episode of season 3 here of the Cyber Tap. And so thanks again for joining. Now, folks that are tuning into this, our format will be mostly the same. We're going to unpack the news a little bit. But as we get into the later part of the episode, we're just going to have kind of an open conversation about cybersecurity from our guest host perspective, which, again, we're excited to have Spaff here. So first, we want to unpack the news. So, Dr. Spafford, is there anything in the news that kind of caught your eye recently that you'd like to chat about today?
Well, it's actually hard to go very long without finding something interesting in the news related to the area of cyber and online privacy. The couple of things that have caught my interest most recently has been ongoing discussion about voting and also some of the efforts to shut down some Chinese information processing telecommunication companies in the U.S. I think both of those have a lot of interesting overtones to them.
Let's start with the voting. So I see a lot of headlines about voter security, voter fraud. Now, with the pandemic raging on and things continuing, the introduction of more mail-in voting, because I think some people pretend like mail-in voting hasn't been a thing before with absentee ballots. I mean, this has been around, but there's some concerns about fraud. And of course, the nation states that are coming in and trying to monkey about in our election. So what is it about the voter and the voter security that's kind of catching your eye, and what's trending in the cyber realm today?
Well, a lot of it has to do with just the way that ballots are cast and counted. Mm. So vote by mail isn't that unusual. There are a number of states that have been doing it for years. So Oregon, Colorado, Alaska are examples where, because they're so spread out and it's difficult for voters sometimes to get to a voting place, they've been using vote by mail for years. And most states have had absentee ballots that they've used for years. The incidence of fraud is extraordinarily small. And it appears to be largely driven by politics this year, mm-hmm. as to where the discussion on that is. But that's not really a cyber issue.
Right.
The place where cyber is a concern is that, because of the pandemic, a number of people have said, well, why can't we vote online? And the answer is, we can't, because we don't know a safe way to do it. It's far more difficult. The U.S. mail system is, or at least was, very dependable, protected by law for anonymity and timeliness. Doing things online is much more difficult, because if we cast our votes online, we don't know that they're received or counted. We don't know if there are viruses or hacking that are into any of the systems that may be changing votes or preventing them from even being sent. Some of the best minds in cybersecurity have been studying this problem for well over a decade. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion that has been come up by every group that hasn't been trying to sell something
right,
has been that it simply isn't safe to do. And even recent government reports out of NIST and Homeland Security both made the same conclusions. It just isn't safe to do online.
So I have a question, Spaff. What is the difference between the way you're kind of talking about online voting versus the digital voting machines that we see? I think Diebold makes them, or somebody like that, that we know there's been some problems with those in the past. What makes that a better option than the online from a cybersecurity perspective?
Well, they're still a bad option, but they're better okay. than online. this has been frustrating for me for well over a decade, because Tippecanoe County, right where we're located, uses some very poor machines.
Right.
That the machine just accumulates a vote count in memory. And so you cast your vote and you see what's on the screen, but you have no way of knowing if the counters inside have actually been incremented properly. There's no audit trail. There's no way to go back and check to make sure that the user's intent was accurately registered. Mm-hmm. It's possible at the end of a voting period, because we have advanced voting here at vote centers, but at the end of election day, somebody could try to read the numbers out of that machine, and if they're all zero or they're all 10 million, there's no way to go back and recover or to show that those weren't actually the way they were cast. That's a problem.
Yeah.
And it's a problem because not only is it something that, because of either error or because of attack, it's designed to throw the election, but in some ways, and this is a concern for online voting as well, if you can destroy people's confidence in the voting process, which is currently what some people are trying to do as far as mail-in ballots, if you can destroy people's confidence, then they don't trust the election, they don't trust the outcome.
Right.
And that's a very bad result. We need to be able to trust that our vote is counted in an appropriate way for whomever it is that we vote for. And any changes in the technology should be carefully thought out. We should have auditability. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't be casting aspersions on mechanisms without proof, because that's very bad. And for the upcoming election, in general, I think electronic voting machines, as administered by the people administering them, they go out, they try very hard to make sure they're done properly and accurately. And the instance of problems that have occurred, there have been problems, but they've been localized and small.
Right. Right. I mean, it's hard for a small voting area, even like ours, to sway the large elections, the national elections, because it's, even if you try to stuff ballots or do something crazy, there's not that much impact, and there's usually a big enough gap in the results anyway. But the local elections, I mean, you heard about the issues, and you can research these that happen in local elections, especially around places where there's organized crime and things like that, and forcing people's votes. So you're going to vote for this guy, or, you know, voter, what do they call it? Intimidation, things like that. Those are great stories. But I think that, imagine someone being able to sway an entire election with lines of code.
It's actually not that inconceivable. If you look back, the national election for president between Senator Gore and George Bush was really decided by less than 100,000 votes,
right,
that may have been cast mistakenly. So it doesn't take a lot, perhaps. And it's not just presidential. It's, for instance, the election of senators and governors can have a big impact. So there are concerns there, and we're slowly moving in the right direction. A number of states have passed laws to change their voting machines. Indiana has passed such a law, but it doesn't really come into force until 2022. But we also need laws in place to do what are called risk-limiting audits. After the votes have been cast and there's a paper, durable copy of the ballot, we need to pick a random number of precincts and compare those ballots to the electronically recorded vote to make sure that there isn't some discrepancy that's been introduced. We don't have to do it everywhere. That would be expensive and time-consuming. But there are mathematical methods we can use for random sampling to gain greater confidence. And then if that turns out to show discrepancies, then we can do a wholesale recount. I would just say right now, the system as we have it, whether it's with electronic machines or by mail-in ballot, is highly trustworthy, despite what some people with a vested interest in disrupting the vote might want to say. And I would encourage everyone to be sure to register and find a way to cast your ballot that is legal and appropriate.
So you're not saying vote early and vote often?
No. No, that... that's a great line. And the problem with that is that it is it's a felony, and then you have your right to vote in future elections.
Well, I really appreciate your perspective on online voting, because I do hear people saying, well, why can't we just come up with a very secure solution for online voting? And of course, that even the idea of that makes my skin crawl, knowing how vulnerable online applications are just in general and by default, and some designed with security in mind from the very beginning. You know, no system is safe. That was the byline of that German film we reviewed in our last podcast. No system is safe. And certainly an online voting mechanism, you know, would have its own vulnerabilities. I think that makes an interesting segue to your next, the next thing that you mentioned, Spaff, about the Chinese manufacturing companies wanting to get into infrastructure delivering being blocked. I'm really interested in your take on that. And, you know, I think we're talking about Huawei and 5G and things like that. Those headlines are all over the news. So what are you seeing there, and kind of what's your takeaway on what's going on in that space?
Well, we need to be aware that we may live in the United States, at least I'm assuming that's where most of the listeners are, and we use products that have English names on them, but parts of them and perhaps some of the infrastructure we don't see can be produced around the world. Mm-hmm. If we look at telecommunications, Some are produced by companies in Europe, for instance, Ericsson as an example, or Nokia. The Chinese firm Huawei produces a lot of telecommunications equipment as well. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese government has been backing Huawei, providing them a lot of assistance in developing new technologies and getting patents. The issue that then comes up is that for our next generation of telecommunications and wireless, 5G, what your phones connect to, but mm-hmm. lots of other things too, when we talk of Internet of Things, whose equipment is that going to run on? Whose computers at the back end and right. the routers and networking gear? The problem is that the products coming out of China are not entirely trustworthy. Mm. They have a history of shipping things that have vulnerabilities in them, and they're not the only country, but this is true of China, vulnerabilities that allow the Chinese government to snoop or sure. to alter what's going across the network. They control it very heavily within their borders, and they're very interested in getting that out into other countries. Part of it is that the code that's produced, and there have been a number of examinations of Huawei 5G code, very buggy. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear if that is buggy because it's sloppy or because it gives a deniable way to allow them to get access. But either way, it's a great concern. And as a result, various government agencies in different countries around the world have been saying, no, we just can't take the chance, particularly when China has been exercising censorship on their own citizens,
sure.
Denying access to U.S. companies, stealing all kinds of intellectual property throughout the world to support their own industry. And this has been a great concern.
Do you think this is the appropriate response from not only the United States, but other nations, as you mentioned, when we look at things and the products coming from companies like Huawei or even TikTok, right? TikTok's in the news because it's a Chinese company, and the United States is considering banning TikTok and forcing it to be sold to a U.S.-based company for what they hope would be some more transparency. Do you think this is the right response?
It may be part of the right response, but not by itself. We don't seem to have a good government-organized response to some of the things China has been doing. And it's not just China. Russia is also
sure.
this, although in a different manner. The Russians are much more targeted. They have a smaller investment in this arena, and they target specific kinds of industries and things. The Chinese have so many people they can throw against the problem that they just try to collect everything and then sort it out later, which is, you know, I mean, from the standpoint of using their resources, sure, they got lots of people they can do that with, but it creates problems for us. Things that people don't ordinarily recognize about this, for instance, if a U.S. company wants to do business in China, they have to disclose all of their source code. All of right. their encryption keys, they have to allow the Chinese to install Chinese software on their computers. And this means everything that they have can be stolen. Just by law, that's the way China set it up.
Right. So there's almost no line in between corporations and the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese government, if you will.
That's correct. They own a major interest, if not the whole company. For most right. every Chinese company.
Certainly the successful ones.
Yeah, yes. And we've seen a lot of U.S. designs directly copied by yeah. the Chinese into their products.
See that they in the airline industry.
Airline, defense, space, yeah. medicine, robotics. So
entertainment
they don't
likenesses, spend, all those, yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, they don't have to spend any of the money to do the research. And mm-hmm. as a result, we do the research, they steal the information, make the products, and then sell it cheaper in the world market. And our industries suffer as a result. That's just some of the bad behavior. There's a lot of other sure. things that China is doing. And there have been a lot of news reports about various people in the U.S. who've been arrested for espionage or not disclosing their ties to Chinese organizations, and many, many other things. And as a result, we really ought to have a national strategy for dealing with China, which we don't. And we certainly don't have any kind of strategy for dealing with the Russians, mm-hmm. who are once again attempting to conduct influence operations to impact the election. They also were involved in espionage, only for whatever reason, the current administration doesn't want to say anything critical of Russia. And as mm-hmm. a result, they're being much bolder in the things they've been doing. The internet is worldwide. It's connected worldwide. And our philosophy as a country has been to try to promote the free interchange of information. These countries have been using that philosophy to take things from us and yet erecting barriers inside their own country for our ability to communicate with their people, to have open flow of news. I mean, regularly talking to my Chinese students, they appreciate being in the U.S. because they can have access to news and reference resources that the Chinese government acts as if they don't exist. People inside China know something happened around Tiananmen Square, but they have no idea what it was because they can't get right. access to that information. Lots of other things like that. So we have some very interesting problems politically in the way that the internet functions, in censorship, in countries using it for economic advantage and stealing intellectual property that really need to be confronted at a high level. And for at least the last 4 or 5 years, there we really have not done that.
Right. So, I think it's definitely an unprecedented time. It's very interesting. I think that's in the world of cybersecurity or security or even technology in general. It seems like as we progress, new things open up and, it makes things challenging, to say the least. And on a geopolitical scale, makes things even more dynamic, right? The weight of these entire nation states that are very sophisticated in what they do and have purpose behind the things that they do, whether it be election meddling or espionage through control of corporations. You mentioned the history of that, and the history is there, and it's not just in software bugs. We know without a doubt that during the manufacturing process, things are put into systems intentionally just for the sole purpose to phone home or to pass information back to the interested party. And so we've seen those types of things going on for years. And I really appreciate your perspective on that. It's interesting that, it's not just to say we can't do that or we can't do this. There's got to be a multifaceted approach as it relates to not only cybersecurity, but I mean, we're really delving into the State Department's role and how we handle foreign policy.
Right. So. Well, it's an interesting, another thing that was in the news recently that's part of this is there are at least a half a dozen countries that have been conducting online espionage to try to steal information about COVID-19 vaccines.
I saw that.
Right. So China, Russia, Iran, and some others, North Korea, have been trying to break into various research labs and universities to steal information or possibly to tamper with information about effective vaccines.
Right.
And you can sort of understand why they might want to steal the information if they can't do the research themselves. But the tampering aspect is so that maybe set vaccine development back in countries so mm-hmm. that theirs is able to progress. And at first, so they have bragging rights that theirs is first or theirs is best. These kinds of things can have broad ranging effects. And we simply have not come to grips with how bad it can be. And we really need to start focusing on this.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, thanks for bringing, kind of both of those topics up from the headlines recently. Mike, what did you see anything interesting in the headlines that you wanted to chat about today?
The story that I looked out for or that I found was from CNBC.com, written by Kate Rogers and Betsy Spring. titled We Are Outnumbered, Cybersecurity Pros Face a Huge Staffing Shortage as Attacks Surge During the Pandemic. Mm. Thought I would kind of give a little softball. This probably has some duh, that's obvious, parts to the story. But I thought there were some interesting points to pull out. So there's actually, I kind of separated out into two sections I thought went together. I'll kind of mention parts of the first one and we can have a quick discussion. Cybersecurity workers were taken off some or all of their typical security duties to assist with other IT-related tasks, including mm-hmm. equipping mobile workforces, according to an April survey from a global nonprofit, ISC2, the largest association of cybersecurity professionals. Survey of 256 cyber pros found nearly half were retasked and that a quarter said cybersecurity incidents increased since the transition to remote work, with some seeing as many as double the number of incidents. Separate data from another nonprofit cybersecurity group, the Information Systems Security Association, found a 63% increase in cyber attacks related to the pandemic, calling COVID a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for hackers and online scammers. Here's a direct quote from David Shearer, who's the CEO of ISC2. We are outnumbered. The people that are doing bad things, whether it's a nation state type of activity or cybercrime, the good guys and gals were vastly outnumbered prior to the pandemic. So I guess my question is, do you feel that these statistics are accurate?
I think generally they are. They reflect some underlying structural and economic issues in the field. I'm not surprised to hear numbers of that order of magnitude. That sort of consistent with my experience.
So how does a company prioritize whether resources should be used for their securing their cyber assets or getting their workforce operating in the new state of doing business?
Well, I think that's kind of a false choice, is they should be doing both. Mm-hmm. This is the COVID-19 issue is kind of a natural disaster. It's like if there was a flood and you'd say, well, which is more important, getting business done or drying out the offices? Well, you want to be doing both. And yes, maybe you have to make another investment. Maybe you have to change operations. But that, again, it goes to kind of the structural issue that we have in the field. Many companies underinvest in security. They don't think about disaster management. They don't necessarily value training their employees. And as a result, when a problem comes along, they often find that they're not well positioned to deal with it. This could have been, for instance, a really bad flu season, a large earthquake or a hurricane, and many of these same companies would also likely be caught flat-footed because they haven't invested in or given thought to how to deal with a surge or a disaster.
All right, to kind of continue that, this is the other part of the article. That same group, ISC2, reported in late 2019 that 2.8 million professional workers in cybersecurity jobs globally, but the industry would need another 4 million trained workers in order to properly defend organizations and close the skill gap, which included about 500,000 workers needed in the U.S. to meet that demand. In order to reach that, Shearer said to fill the talent gap, more outreach needs to be done to recruit younger workers in the aging workforce, as well as more diverse cybersecurity workers, which seems kind of a duh statement. But how do you actually get those younger workers or those more diversity into the workforce?
Yeah, good question. So in part, I think one of the reasons we have such a huge need is a lot of cybersecurity is done incorrectly. We are continuing to use computing systems and setups that are inherently weak. Mm. Companies aren't willing to invest in stronger alternatives, even though we know how to build them. So many of those people they need are basically to prop up damaged and poorly constructed systems. So that's part of the problem. The workforce, yeah, it's difficult, and in part, not everybody is cut out to work in this field. They have to be able to understand some about how computing works. They have to understand some about programming logic, computer mm-hmm. system logic. They need a little more advanced math and statistics than most people. And unfortunately, we are in a situation, we've been in a situation for quite some time where the majority of our graduate students are from other countries. They're mm-hmm. not from the U.S. We aren't as welcoming to those people staying after they graduate as we used to be. And we have an awful lot of people in this country who their idols and their dream job is anything from professional sports or massage therapist or lawyer or something like that, rather than working in a field that's technical. We've done a terrible job as a field in attracting underrepresented groups and women. The CS program, for instance, at Purdue is only about 17% female. We're the oldest computer science department in the country, and just last year we graduated our first Black female PhD.
Right.
I mean, these numbers are terrible. We should be doing much better at this, but there are systemic issues. We have people at lower grades who discourage women, discourage minorities from pursuing high-tech careers. We have school districts where a number of underrepresented populations go to school, like on some of the Indian Nation schools, who are very poor and can't even afford modern computer systems,
sure, right.
let alone teach it. And so all of these people are at a disadvantage before they ever get to a college level where they can learn. And then a third part of the issue is that cybersecurity is a very vast area. NIST has a classification, and NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, called the NICE. And I can never remember what that acronym is for.
It's cyber education, I think, is the back half of the CE and NICE.
Exactly. And there are 33 different career paths that they've identified.
Right. With associated KSAs, the knowledge and skills and abilities.
Exactly. And the problem is that we haven't done a good job of communicating to potential students. There are an array of jobs they could take that they could have fulfilling careers in this field. And if we had more of those filled, that would also help address some of the need. Not everybody needs to be an investigator. Not everybody has to be the one who's responding to incidents. Getting people who know how to configure systems and train users and select the right software, those are all really valuable and well-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to convey that.
So, Spaff, I have a question along those lines. What's your take on the ability for you know, our institution and other institutions of higher learning or training groups to upskill and reskill talent from fields that maybe don't have the outlook and the need for jobs like cybersecurity does? So just in general, kind of what's your take on upskilling and reskilling?
I think we're well positioned for it at Purdue University.
Yeah.
We have several master's programs that are ideal for this, and we have brought in students who've been out of school for many years, who get into the program, get their degrees and go on and do great things. The obstacle there is both the time and the expense. So somebody who needs to reskill or upskill may very well have car loans and a mortgage and a family to support, and going to school is expensive. I think Purdue Global is an example of something that the Purdue family of education has a great program for graduate education in cyber, mm-hmm. and that can be taken part-time remotely. And so that is another alternative that can be used.
Yeah, I did a degree from Global because it was paid for by the university. Thank you, Purdue, for doing that. And I said, well, why not if it was going to be given to me? So I did one. And you're right.
They didn't just issue.
Well, they didn't just give it to me. I did the program, yeah. And it was a lot of work, but it was, you know, and I had the benefit of some assistance being that there was no tuition. but it is still tough because there's an amount of work to do. And I do have car payments and a mortgage and two kids and all those things that Spaff, you mentioned. It does make it challenging, but yeah, it's, I think I agree with you. I think we're well positioned. It's something we're trying, you know, here at the CyberTap to be involved with as well, you know, kind of cover all the gamuts. We, you know, our major partnerships with industry where we're doing upskilling and reskilling and trying to take technology generalists like myself and Mike that 20 years ago we were in, while you were researching here at the university, we were students in CPT and, you know, learned how to be point and click administrators or application developers and now need a chance to reskill and, you know, learn that kind of cyber mindset. So yeah, I think it's interesting. Great article, Mike. I'm going to jump over to some questions for Spaff now. Go ahead, please.
Let me add one thing to that, which is this is a profession. Law is another one. Medicine, there are several others where it's important to stay current. So it isn't just a matter of the classes. It's a matter of after the classes, staying current and learning new things. So some of the professional associations like ACM and ISSA offering regular classes and conferences and continuing education. If people who are in the general field of computing take advantage of that and keep their skills sharp, then we don't have quite the same problem of coming back and doing it all over again. It's really more the people who are outside the field or who after they've got their degree, they just decide they don't need to learn anymore. Those are the people at the disadvantage right now that we have to find better ways of reaching.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And okay. I with some industry certifications, at least the good ones, and I've got my own opinion on and how I view industry certifications, but the good ones do require you to keep learning to maintain that certificate. So yeah, I see your point there. It's a interesting perspective. So I think we wanted to spend just a few minutes here, kind of in the last few minutes of the episode today, just maybe some get to know you questions a little bit. What's going on in your world? So the first question, Spaff, and it's something for our younger listeners, because we do have a lot of folks that are just entering, the folks listening to this podcast, just entering a career in cybersecurity. And I think there's some curiosity about what were the early days like in cybersecurity research. So as we mentioned, top of the show, you've been doing this for 40 years, 34 years of those, or 34 of those years at Purdue. So there wasn't even necessarily a field of cybersecurity, at least it wasn't maybe called that. So what were those early days like and compared to now?
You're right. There really wasn't a field like this. The earliest work was largely financed by the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. And they were most interested in things like cryptography and protecting secrets on machines so they couldn't be taken out of those machines. But those machines weren't on networks. They were mainframes. They were building-sized computers. So the kind of research that was being done was foundational. It was very important. People learning about the field now should learn something about what was discovered back then and some of the things that were learned, but not a lot of them can necessarily be applied to current systems. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until really the late 80s, early 90s that we began to have networking in any significant way. And that opened up all kinds of problems because then we were at a point where anybody who had access to the network might have access to your computer. So we had a whole new set of concerns that came into play at that point. Now we're at a point where not only do we have networks of wires, but we have wireless, and everybody's carrying around a computer in their pocket.
Yeah.
And a lot of our data is stored. Well, we don't even know where it's stored. It's in the cloud somewhere, wherever the cloud is. And so that opens yet another generation of problems that protection, we can't constrain it to a machine or a network segment. But it's everywhere. So the field has really evolved from, as I said, protecting mainframes and largely encryption and some software engineering aspects now to where we have this huge amorphous cloud of computing and processing that we have to protect from a global threat. It's really quite an amazing set of changes.
Yeah, I was just doing some research recently for a presentation, and I think it was in 2018, there were 7 billion connected devices. And then in 2019, there was 27 billion. And the exponential growth in connectedness is absolutely incredible. The statistic I saw that said that there's 127 new internet connected devices being connected in this world every second. So every, if you think about that, then that was just obviously measuring that exponential growth over time. But every second, 127 new things are connected to the internet.
And the more we do Internet of Things, cars, refrigerators, drones.
Exactly.
It's that number is just going to increase.
Wait, do we go back to punch cards then? No.
I don't think so. So what trends are worth tracking right now in cybersecurity and privacy, in your opinion, Spaff?
Well, I think there's been a lot of hype around artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
There haven't been really dramatic changes, I don't believe, in that field. It's been more the case that with more storage and faster processors, things that we were doing, we can now do faster. But the big problem there is because it promises cheaper operation of some things and reduction in number of people in the loop. We may want to adopt AI, machine learning kinds of solutions, but we don't know enough about how some of those things worked or work or where they take their data. There's a whole field called adversarial learning that governs protecting AI. So a concern there that we have to look for is the too eager adoption of that as new technology that introduces a whole new set of risks that we don't understand. I think that's a problem.
Right.
And it shows up in a number of places where we want to give control of our cars or our airplanes or military systems or other things to computer systems. And what we've seen with computer systems is they can be faulty. They can make puzzling and surprising decisions. And what's been demonstrated with systems such as facial recognition, the people who program them and give them the data may actually program them with an unknown or unstated bias.
Sure.
So if people haven't seen this, there've been a number of studies where facial recognition systems were trained on large collections of photographs that didn't include people of color. And right. So as a result, they were like 87% effective on recognizing, for instance, my face. But if you were to present somebody with a dark complexion, it would be off 87% of the time, mm-hmm. or some large number.
Because the sample that they were used to for the machine to learn against wasn't universal enough.
Exactly.
That definitely echoes. Was it a year or two ago where there was a social experiment where they wrote a learning code and they opened it up to the public to do through like social posts and things? And the machine or the code would adapt people's dialogue, whatever, to build its own personality. And I think within a couple of weeks, it turned into a foul mouth racist.
Not surprising.
Yep, that's exactly right. And another example where this has come up is a system was developed for a bank to try to determine if someone was worthy of a loan, whether it was too much of a risk or not. And the data they used had been based on redlining by people who discriminated against certain immigrant and people of color, various minorities. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the training data was biased against them. And even though those people generally tried very hard, were very good with the loans, they would have been good risks, the AI program rejected them. The bias was built in because of the data.
Right.
So we have to be extremely careful with systems as we develop and as we give them further autonomy to make sure that we aren't perpetuating further problems for various people.
Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. Something certainly worth kind of watching out for over the next several years. So one last question for you, Spaff, before we jump off this episode. What is one thing a budding cyber professional could or should be doing to kind of ensure them a long, productive, and lucrative career, right? So we want our listeners to be successful. Do you have any, if you could narrow it down, what was a single piece of advice you might give them?
I can speak for my experience and that for many of my students. I can't say that this is advice.
Universal, sure, everyone. Sure.
Yeah. But the idea that learning new things, trying new things, not only in computing, but generally, is something that will keep you engaged and productive and valuable. So I encourage my students, for instance, to read several sources of news, mm-hmm. not computing news, but world news.
Sure.
My undergraduate class last year, as a result, found out about the COVID threat a month before most of their peers in the university, because they were paying attention to what was going on outside, and we talked about it. Even though it wasn't cyber, and when you're looking at computing, is okay, maybe you spent all your time studying graphics, but read things about algorithms and AI and security.
Right.
Even if you don't understand it all, stretch a little bit. Try to learn things in your field, near your field, and even outside your field, because those things will help continue to get you thinking about how to address problems and how to take ideas from other places mm-hmm. and apply them to the problems you have and be able to better talk with others. This is why when we talk about diversity, it's not just diversity of appearance, but background and outlook and maybe right. even discipline on teams brings other perspectives and other ways of looking at things. And if you're going to be productive, you need to embrace other trains of thought, other mm-hmm. ways of doing things than what you think you need for just the thing you're working on.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
It's a very general answer.
Yeah.
But it's a way of life. It's a way of thinking, is particularly for people who are students now, your career is only starting and what you get in classes is not sufficient for you to be productive and successful in life. It's a start. It's a base. You've got to use that and build on it on your own.
Yeah. Somebody told me during my undergrad studies here at Purdue, in this course now a couple decades ago, a geek that could speak will always have a job. And I've never forgot that. And so I took almost all of my free electives as communications courses to try to build a rounded out skill set, just so that, and I saw the brilliance of that statement even probably before I could fully understand how important it was, because I hadn't entered my career yet. But having soft skills and doing things, you know, over our summer session, Spaff, we did a segment called Go Outside Nerds, where we encourage people to simply go outside and do something that maybe they don't usually do. We talked about going kayaking, and while that isn't necessarily to build your career, it's to give you some different perspective to go out and do some things, because you never know when some crazy skill set, some you know, common ground to find something with someone you're working with, a client or an employer, is going to help you move forward. And I think that's something that sometimes we lack in the IT field and in the cybersecurity industry. We spend too much time laser focused, and I couldn't agree more. Going out and looking at multiple news sources, getting that worldview or different perspective, having conversations with folks outside of the cyber industry is really critical. So yeah, I love that. Thanks for that piece of advice.
It's much better than my answer, which was grow 7 feet and develop an outside shot.
Yeah, right, exactly. And you alluded to that earlier. We got people idolizing athletes. Well, yeah, maybe we need people to start looking at this career as an alternative, right? Because we're not going to be all 7-footers. me standing in at a whopping 5'8¾".
Well, what I give as advice to my students when I'm meeting with them is, what is your goal in life? If your goal in life is to memorize the instruction set for an Intel chip, that's an awfully narrow goal.
Yeah.
If your goal is to make the world a better place, to be able to interact with people, make their lives better, have fun, and grow as a person, nothing in that is directly related to computing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Your vocation and what you're learning is a skill set for you to make a living, and maybe you can apply it to make the world a better place. But if your overall goal is to be happy, to grow, to help other people, to make a difference, there are lots of ways to do that. So don't constrain yourself with what you look at. Is be open to new experiences and learning new things. And computing is a great way to do that because it applies lots of places. And if you learn it well, you can get paid well. But it's not a way of life. There's lots more that can be done.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's great advice and great wisdom to wrap up the show. So Spaff, thank you so much for joining us today. Absolute pleasure to have you on the show to get your insight on a number of topics. Very much appreciate the work that you are doing, the work that you've done over the years here at Purdue and in the field of cybersecurity. So Mike, that wraps us, I think, for today. Just want to extend, another, as always, a thank you to our listeners. You can reach out to us, cybertappodcast@purdue.edu. We always appreciate your feedback and input. Thanks, everybody. Take care.